Captain Featherston Delk, Reel 7. We're talking about when you were picking up the prisoners from the Admiral Graf Spee at Montevideo. There's a couple of stories you've got. One in particular of your visit there of a drunken sailor. I wonder if you'd mind telling us that story.
Well, when the time came to leave Montevideo, there was the most enormous crowd of people, perhaps 10,000, who came to see us off. And we left after sunset. The ship was floodlit, and any activity on board was greeted by applause from the Uruguayans. They didn't seem to cheer much, except perhaps with football matches, but anybody sort of doing anything on board got a round of applause, which seemed to us rather strange. Anyway, eventually the time came for us to sail. About 7 o'clock in the evening, I think it was. And the minutes and the seconds ticked by, and finally came the moment when we should have left. But the master-at-arms reported to the commander there was one sailor missing. And we bit our nails a bit, until suddenly the far end of this very long jetty, perhaps 500-600 yards long, there appeared one single figure. And he slowly wove his way down this jetty. And as he did so, all the clapping stopped, and this entire crowd of some thousands eventually became totally silent. You could have heard a pin drop. And this sailor wove his way down the jetty, mute and uncomprehending. And as he got to the bottom of the gangway, three of our men went down, grabbed him, and bore him on board. The gangway was removed. The ship gave three blasts on her siren, which indicated that she was going astern, and she began gently to move. And the most enormous cheer, the first of them all, came from the crowd. It was really, really quite astonishing, and I've never forgotten it.
There's just one other story I wanted to pick up. You've shown me a collection of stories. I wonder if you'd mind telling us about the story of when they accidentally fired the hedgehog in Charleston Navy Yard. That was on HMS Houghton. It's going back a bit, but I mean that's it's quite an interesting story. If you mind telling us about that.
Yes, we had this weapon called the hedgehog, which was mounted where a gun would normally be, that's to say up forward, and it fired a salvo of 24 projectiles ahead of the ship, which was meant to sink a submarine if you hit it. And one day in Charlestown Navy Yard, one of my sailors was showing his American girlfriend round the ship. And they came to this hedgehog mounting, and she said to the sailor, "How does this thing work?" And he said, "Well, you just turn this handle." And he proceeded to turn it. And a salvo of 24 projectiles sailed over the dockyard wall and landed on the parade ground of an army barracks the other side of the wall. Having turned the handle, there was nothing he could do to stop it, and so there it was. Well, I heard about this, and so I rustled up a party of sailors who dashed off to the dockyard gate and then onto the barracks, where they proceeded to shoulder these projectiles, which were lying on the parade ground, and bore them back to the ship. Well, that was fine, and I think I may have apologized to the American soldiers. Anyway, the next day, the Boston papers were full of it, especially praised the behavior of the sailors for the way they handled these deadly missiles. What they didn't know, and I never let on, was that these missiles were sand-filled practice ones, which had been loaded ready for the firing trials the next morning at sea. Anyway, we got a lot of marks for clearing up the mess, and a lot of marks for the sailors for their intrepid bravery in handling these deadly missiles.
Now, that was just an interlude. Getting back to the Ajax, you escorted the ship back with the POWs aboard, and then was it then you went into the Mediterranean? Because you spent a long time in the Mediterranean.
That's right. As soon as we got back to England, we went into Chatham, and I think gave a few days' leave to the sailors, and then sailed for Malta in the Mediterranean, where we were to spend the next 2.5 years or so.
Based at Malta.
Hmm.
And what do you remember? What were you doing? What was the purpose of the Ajax in the Mediterranean?
Well, there was a lot going on in the Mediterranean in those days. There was trouble in Trieste, you may remember, with President Tito, who would have liked to have annexed the place. There was the problem with the illegal immigrants, as they were referred to, trying to get into what is now Israel. There were still mines, danger from mines, particularly in the Adriatic. They would be German mines from the Second World War. There was the general business, what is known as showing the flag, that's to say, going around on goodwill visits to various ports and islands in the Mediterranean.
Now, which should we deal with first in more detail? Which comes to mind first?
Oh, I think probably some minesweeping episode.
Tell us about that.
You may remember that two British destroyers, the Volage and the Somerys, were mined in the Corfu Channel. Neither of them actually sank, but they were both very, very severely damaged and suffered a great many casualties. And they might have been laid by the Yugoslavs, these mines, or the Albanians, I'm not sure which. Anyway, it was decided that these mines should be swept. And so Ajax went up to cover the operation being carried out by the minesweepers from Malta. And I was sent away in the ship's motorboat to, first of all, identify the mines, so what their type and nationality was, and secondly, to sink them by gunfire, by rifle fire, that is. So away we went, and sure enough, the minesweepers began to cut these mines. They were German GY-type mines, practically brand new, and quite easily identified. Anyway, we were provided with rifles with armor-piercing bullets, and so we began to shoot with these things, my sailors and me. Unfortunately, one of my sailors fired his rifle 4 inches from my left ear, and I'm still suffering from the deafness even to this day. But their lordships were kind enough to give me what's called a hurt certificate. And when I finally left the Navy, I was given an extra payment on my pension as a recompense for having been deafened in the Corfu Channel. The first thing I did with the money which I got was to go buy myself a new shotgun, which no doubt made me even deafer. But there it was. Anyway, these mines were all swept, and they were eventually, some of them were taken ashore for sort of final examination. But they were German GY mines. The Ajax was in no danger. She was there really to open up on the Albanians if they tried to interfere in any way with our minesweeping.
And did you have any, I mean, they were German mines, but had they been recently laid by...
They had been very recently laid, In fact, the grease on the fittings was still greasy.
And you suspected the Albanians
We did indeed, because the Albanians had complained about our ships going through the Corfu Channel, which they were entirely entitled to do so. I suppose out of a fit of pique, they laid these mines to deter us.
Now, perhaps if we take the Palestinian patrol that you were on next, tell me about this.
Well, that you may remember it was the government's policy to keep the Jews, as they were called in those days, out of Palestine, but before the State of Israel was established. And they used to run ships from Europe full of illegal immigrants. And it was our job to prevent them doing so, to either arrest the ships or stop them and arrest them, take them into Haifa, probably, whence the immigrants would be shipped off to Cyprus to camps there. And the biggest one of these ships was called the Exodus 1947. And she'd sailed, I think, from Marseille in southern France. And she was shadowed all the way by the Navy and other people. And eventually we intercepted her about 70 or 80 miles, I should think, off Haifa. We had, I think, two destroyers with us, and they put boarding parties on board, and we provided some of the sailors for boarding. And they had a fairly hot reception on board this ship, which had taken quite a lot of precautions in the way of being able to defend themselves. Anyway, we didn't actually have any deaths, but we had a certain number of injuries. But still, this ship wouldn't stop. And she had welded on her side lengths of railway track sticking out at right angles to the hull, so that destroyers would have difficulty in getting alongside and putting boarding parties on board. Anyway, it was all rather difficult until my captain said, to hell with this, I think we better show a bit of force. And so we steamed up astern of the Exodus at 20 knots. An Ajax at 20 knots is rather a fine sight. It was a great big bow wave. And that finally broke the morale of these chaps on board the Exodus 47. And she was captured and taken into Haifa with a boarding crew. They eventually were taken off to Cyprus. That, of course, was before the State of Israel was finally established. But they were very messy operations, always. And, of course, our destroyers used to suffer quite a certain amount of superficial damage by going alongside and having to put their sailors on board. So it wasn't a very popular job. In fact, my young brother was in the same operation with the Exodus 47. He was serving as a sub-lieutenant in the destroyer Cheviot, one of these destroyers based at Malta.
Now, what about the showing of the flag? What's that side of it? Tell us a bit
about
that.
Well, that was immense fun, of course. We showed it in Cyprus, in Greece, in Trieste, in Alexandria, in Algiers, in Taranto, in Italy, in Naples. We always had to put on a good show. We had, of course, on board a Royal Marines band, which is always a tremendous draw. So we would land them to make a good old umpa noise, as they do so well. Otherwise, we were entertained ashore, and we gave cocktail parties on board for the local dignitaries and senior military people and politicians.
Now, Taranto, I know you have a story about an Italian officer that had met the Ajax before.
Well, that's right. We gave this cocktail party at Taranto, which, of course, was the principal naval base for the Italian Navy in the war. And we gave this cocktail on board on the quarterdeck, and I suddenly sighted a rather bold Italian officer, naval officer, with a terrible scar running from the front to the back of his head. So I said to him, in English, I couldn't speak in Italian, "How come the damage?" And he said, "This ship did it." He was apparently the gunnery officer of an Italian destroyer called the Artiglieri. And she, in fact, had met up with the Ajax in 1940 and had come off worst. And a shell splinter had gone through the director tower of this destroyer in which he was sitting, and it creased his skull, dropped his tin helmet in half, and it had fallen over his ears. Anyway, I said, "Well, that's interesting, because I saw your ship blow up when I was serving in HMS Malaya. A hell of a bang it was, too." "Anyway," I said, "would you like to see a picture of your ship blowing up?" "I should be delighted to," he said. So he went down to my cabin and turned it up in my photograph album. He was absolutely thrilled. And he said, "Can I bring down my friends to have a look?" "Sure," I said, and so down they came. And soon my cabin was full of excited Italians, slapping him on the back and laughing their heads off and seeing how brave Giuseppe had been. Anyway, everybody was extremely happy with this, and this Italian chap went ashore with his head held very high, the hero of the hour.
So, other stories about the Good Shepherd, you call it, when the HMS Ajax visited Salonika. Another goodwill tour.
Well, it was. We went to Salonika, and there was a military mission, a British military mission there, and they invited us to go, or some of us, to go and shoot duck and geese. And so we plodded off in army transport about 45 miles north of Salonika, sort of where Bulgaria and Macedonia join up, where there was a big lake called Lake Diornis. And it was a beautiful day. On the way up there, you could still see the debris of war. There were bomb trolleys still carrying bombs and parked on the airfields. There was a train which had been obviously shot up, I should think, by rockets, and the locomotive had been destroyed. And there were crated Messerschmitts still on the flat cars. Bizarre, it seemed. Anyway, we got eventually to Lake Diornis, and we looked around to see whether there were any locals, and we couldn't see anything. And yet suddenly we heard in the distance the plaintive sound of a shepherd's pipe, and we espied a figure on a hillside, not too far away. So we climbed up and found this chap, who was a shepherd, piping to his sheep. And so one of our military friends, he spoke modern Greek, and he tried to interrogate this chap, but he didn't seem to understand at all. Another chap had been taught classical Greek at school, tried that, no good. French, no good. And then somebody tried German, and this old man's eyes lit up, and he replied with a torrent of broken German. And it transpired that when the Germans had invaded Greece, they'd taken him off as a slave labourer, despite the fact that he knew nothing except how to look after sheep. But he was a pair of hands to them. And he'd been put to work at some factory in the Ruhr, I suppose, making armaments of some sort. Anyway, at the end of the war, he became what they called in those days a displaced person. And the authorities who were dealing with these people asked him where he came from. And he said he was a Greek shepherd. So they pointed out the direction in which Greece lay and told him to get back there as best he could. And so he said he'd walked. And he'd had the very occasional lift. He'd lived off the land. And he'd gone all the way back to the same hillside where he'd been piping to his sheep when the Germans invaded. And there he was. And what a story. What a story this chap could have told if he could have written it down. But he was an almost illiterate peasant, I should think. Charming old boy, but it was really most moving at the time.
Any other stories from your time on the Ajax, on that tour, sort of in the Mediterranean?
Yes, I was persuaded to qualify as a shallow water diver. Shallow water because you breathe pure oxygen and you can only go down to about 30 feet, 33 feet, I think. And I was trained to do this, and so were some of my sailors, in order to be able to search the ship's bottom in case the Arabs or the Jews in Haifa tried to put a bomb or some explosive device under the hull. There was in Haifa a very sort of experienced bomb disposal officer who in fact had won a George Medal for bomb disposal, a chap called Britnell. One day there was a report of a mine drifting in the bay. So Britnell and I went away in the ship's boat, Ajax's motorboat, and we jumped over the side and fastened a rope to this mine and began to tow it towards the shore at the head of the bay. And when we got about 50 yards off, we jumped over the side, waded ashore, and began to pull this mine towards the beach. It was a German mine with what are called Hertz horns, which are usually things sticking out from a mine. Anyway, no sooner did the mine touch the beach than it went off with a most enormous bang. We were, I suppose, about 30 yards away. And luckily, we prostrated ourselves on the beach like lightning. Otherwise, we'd have been blown to bits or carved up by the evening. Anyway, this story eventually made the evening standard in London for some extraordinary reason. I have it in my cuttings book about how we bravely tackled this terrible mine. No bravery at all. It was just bloody foolishness, actually. But anyway, we survived to tell the tale.
Anything? I mean, there's another thing about when you met the HMNZS, the New Zealand ship, Achilles.
Ah, yes. Well, of course, she was one of the two cruisers, or one of the three cruisers, rather. The other one was the Exeter, who had sunk the Grass Bay in 1939. And so after the battle, the Achilles had gone back to New Zealand, and the Ajax had come back to England. And so happened we went to Port Said on a goodwill tour, goodwill visit, there was Achilles on her way home to Great Britain. And so we had a lot of booze consumed between the two ships that night, and we then sailed the following morning back to Malta, and the Achilles stayed on for a few days more, and then finally herself came to Malta. Now, in those days, the commander-in-chief in the Mediterranean was a fearsome admiral called Admiral Sir Algernon Willis. And he'd been sent out to Malta, amongst other things, to get the Mediterranean fleet smartened up to pre-war standards. I'd say he was very careful to watch very carefully when his ships came into harbor. And he used to have a most enormous pair of Japanese binoculars mounted on a tripod outside his office window at Lascaris, which is where the commander-in-chief's office was. And you would see him standing there and looking at you through his binoculars as the ship came in. It was reputed amongst the sailors that they were so powerful that he could even see whether a sailor had a shave or not. Anyway, you had to dress up very, very smartly for entering and leaving Malta under Algernon and Willis. And we, of course, knew the drill. And so there we were, all lined up on deck, as was the custom. And we got no misapprobation from the commander-in-chief. And 2 days later, however, the Achilles came in. And instead of being in the right sort of uniform, all their sailors were stripped to the waist and were wearing sandals instead of shoes and stockings. And we thought, my God, there's going to be trouble about this. And that evening, we gave a cocktail party on board the Ajax, to which we invited the officers of the Achilles, and also the commander-in-chief and certain other dignitaries of Malta. And after a stiff drink, I went up to Sir Algernon and I said, Sir, didn't the Achilles look smart coming in today? Well, Algernon gave me a very thin, wintry smile. Well, he said, I very nearly sent them a signal expressing my disapproval. But then I noticed that all the sailors lined up in the New Zealand ship were suntanned to exactly the same shade of brown. And I thought that showed the sort of attention to detail of which I approved. And so I let them off. And with that, he turned away. And what a man he was. He was granite on the outside, very soft on the inside.
Anything else about your time on the Ajax? And you know, because you were there.
No, she was the happiest ship I ever served in.
Why was she so happy?
Well, I suppose for many of us it was our first overseas peacetime commission, and all the ports and so forth in the Mediterranean were terribly pleased to see us. We were a very happy lot on board. We had two officers who had come out of Japanese prisoner of war camps. And we were wondering how they would react. One had been a survivor of the Exeter, and the other had been a survivor of the Prince of Wales and subsequently of a little destroyer called the Stronghold. Anyway, they arrived on board, went straight to the bar and ordered a stiff glass of gin, and never looked back. We never asked them how they'd been in the Japanese prisoner of war camp. They'd been in Java, I seem to remember. But they very occasionally let drop the odd little anecdote, but we never pressed them, and they didn't really want to discuss it. But they were two of the best and most charming officers that we had, and I kept up with both of them until they died. And such is the sort of comradeship of the sea. But they were very, very robust people to be able to survive Japanese prisoner of war camps.
Now, so how were you? You basically just was the ship decommissioned, or did you leave her?
I eventually brought her home to go on the scrap heap. Very sad. She was going to be broken up in South Wales. In fact, I got a photograph of her. She ran aground at the entrance to some port in South Wales on her way to the knacker's yard.
How did you feel about the scrap heap?
Very sad. Very sad. Well, she was such a name. She was known throughout this Navy and certainly throughout the Mediterranean as being a happy, very efficient, and well-run ship. We had a second captain, actually. Captain Cuthbert joined, left very soon after we got to the Mediterranean, and we had another one, Captain de Courcy Ireland, who died last year at the age of 101. He was a very distinguished aviator in his time, and was responsible very largely for setting up the Australian Navy's air arm.
What was he like? I mean, we interviewed him when he was about 97, but I mean, obviously you don't. What was he like when you knew him?
He was very quiet. I never saw him raise his voice. He was very tolerant. He wasn't such a brilliant ship handler as Captain Cuthbert, but he ran a very happy ship. I saw his obituary, which is in the Times, and realized what an even more distinguished officer he was than we ever knew. He really hid his thing under the bushel and never talked about things or himself, but he'd been a very, very distinguished officer.